Oh, hey, Rodney, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, it's been crazy this morning. Thanks for your flexibility. So, wow, this exhibit that you have up that I haven't seen except in photographs, Days and Occasions, The Unexpected Griot at Southern Exposure Gallery. It just looks really awesome. So tell me about this narrative based on observations and conversations that surround you every day that you depict here in this exhibit, along the lines that you mentioned in the description, in the tradition of the West African griots that perform the role of community historians.
For me, the project started maybe about 15 years ago, where I was really looking for another way to express a narrative. A lot of my work, I'll use a figure or an object, and I was looking for another way to really not have to rely on that so much, because you have to contain everything to a specific figure or a specific face. And it's fine for some projects, but I felt like that human experience and human interaction is a little bit larger than that. And I wanted to make it a little bit more universal, even if some of the text in the piece is a little specific. I wanted to make it a little bit more open, a little bit more universal. So, I was thinking, like, what else could I do? What's the next logical step? And for me, it was text. I was always writing text or having pieces of text along with my images anyway. And so what if I just eliminated the images altogether and just relied on the text? And then I thought about, where am I going to generate this text from? And I walk around a lot, especially back in the day. I'm constantly on Muni or AC Transit. And if you sit down long enough and you sort of listen and sort of observe what's going on around you, time sort of slows down. Time becomes a little bit more, I feel, simultaneous and not as linear. It's not one thing after the other. It's everything sort of happening at once. And I really became fond of the intersections that sort of happen in front of me. And I wanted to be able to honor that and record it in some kind of way. And that's why I have the measurements of time along with the text. So it's what happens between the seconds or minutes.
So, did you interview people? Where did the text that you record
No.
in the work, where'd it come from?
It's all observations or conversations, snippets of conversations I've had with people or things I've overheard.
How many do you have depicted in the in on the in the windows?
Gosh. That's probably about a year's worth.
Oh, seriously. Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Would you say that it ended up being sort of thematic, the things you paid attention to?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Would you say that it was thematic, the different
No, for that piece, no, it was pretty open. I really didn't have a direction, because sometimes observations would come while I was waiting for a bus or something like that, and I would write them down. Some days, I'm paying attention, some days I'm not. So yeah, especially over the course of a year, I would, it's kind of hard to, well, it's not impossible, but it's like I wasn't really concentrated on my theme. I did a for residency at the De Young in 2015. I did the Days and Occasions body of work, but all that text was generated around conversations I've had and observations that I had around the Black Lives Matter. And so that one was a little bit, well, that one was much more directed than what I'm doing at Southern Exposure.
Yeah, I was noticing, and I don't know, I probably knew this from reading your curriculum vitae way back when, but I didn't remember that that you're a printmaker, which kind of
Yeah.
makes me understand now about the idea of, the text. And I don't know if you're a Southerner, but you have your
Yeah,
BFA. Oh, you are. So are you from
I am.
Louisiana? Because you went to Louisiana State University for your BFA
Yeah.
in West Virginia. for your master's. You're from New Orleans, from Louisiana.
Yes, I
Oh,
am.
where? What part?
I'm from Baton Rouge. I was born in Baton
Oh,
Rouge. And
okay.
then my father was in the Air Force, so we traveled around a lot. And but I eventually ended up back in Baton Rouge to go to school.
Oh, okay. Oh, so that's why, when you talked about sort of the Adinkra in the ironwork in Louisiana and, New Orleans, you were speaking from, from being from there too. Not just noticing that, but also it being a part of who you are, with regards to the geography of your person.
Yeah,
Oh.
and just a lot of my family members, they communicate. It was an oral tradition in our house. I mean, my parents are always telling us stories about, things from their past and how they grew up, and they would invite friends over who had similar backgrounds, no matter where, where we're living. And they would do the same thing. So you're sitting around, you're listening to these stories.
Yeah. And you're a veteran as well?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, 'cause I noticed that you've got a lot of work that thematically sort of looks at the idea of war and patriotism. One of particularly with Liberty and Justice for Some at the
Yeah.
Walker Marcel Gallery in L.A. And then
Yeah,
Justice
that
for
was
All.
a
Yeah, at De Anza, UFRAT, Museum of Art at De Anza Community
Yeah.
College, Cupertino. And then you got another one, Never Alone, exploring the bonds between and with members of the armed forces at the San Francisco Art Commission Gallery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
And then also, what do you
those were
think?
last year.
Yeah, and then even Sanctuary City for Liberty and Justice for Some, San Francisco Art Commission again, the gallery there. Yeah. So how long were you in the military? What branch?
I was in the Army National Guard. I was in for 6 years.
Oh, a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Where were you stationed?
It was all stateside until Desert Storm happened, and then my unit in West Virginia, we were activated, and we were there for almost 5 months.
Oh, dang, really? Wow. How was that? What was that like?
You still have to rely on a lot of training to sort of keep you grounded, but I think there are some days that there's no amount of training that you can go through that prepare you for certain surprises and things that happen there. Yeah, it was difficult to say the least. Yeah.
So through all of this, you've been an artist. So how did your art show up in those difficult spaces and places? How
You
does it show
know,
up, I should say?
I've always kept a sketchbook with me, so I'm sure I still have a sketchbook from that time. But then, I think I drew a lot in when I had some downtime, so just to sort of keep my mind occupied with something else. I really haven't made any work about it. I think sometimes it takes me a little while to sort of filter all that and gain some perspective and think about what's the best way, what am I trying to communicate with it. But yeah, it's always, it's one of those things that experiences that you have that I can back and draw from, if and when I decide to make some work about it. It's been, better part of 20 years. So yeah, I'm not really sure if it work make work about that. I mean, even for the veteran show at the Art Commission last year, I didn't make a piece based on my experience. I made it more about my father and his experience in Vietnam and my experiences of him raising me and sort of describing his personality through a set of through a series of folded blankets. But Yeah, I, you know, maybe it's still too close for me to make work for it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, you know, that that your father would be a Vietnam veteran and then you would be a veteran from the Gulf War, and both
Yeah.
those two wars kind of parallel each other around public sentiments around them, insofar as, you know, as opposed to like a, compared to a World War II and a World War I, that was more like,
Right.
yeah, we're doing this for, you know, humanity, and everybody's like rah-rah for it. And then these other
Yeah.
ones like, why are we over there in the first place?
Exactly.
Yeah,
Exactly.
and then you're over there, and your father's over there suffering, you know, and it's still happening. You know, we think about Vietnam, and you know, even on these anniversaries, people are still alive, and the people in Vietnam are still, you know, sort of suffering from on both ends, the Americans and the Vietnamese, from the toxins, you know, that were used
Yeah.
in that war, and then not to mention, you know, the trauma of war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. And then, you know, we've got Desert Storm, like, okay, there's another one of those. Yeah. Wow. So I've noticed one thing about your art, which I always really enjoy, because one has to sort of stay there for a bit and just sort of look at all the different aspects of it. Yours is not like a walk-through kind of, your art is not like you can't like just pass it by. You got to stand, you got to stop and look at it in all of its different aspects. And so like one thing about your work is you really sort of engage your audience in the process of the work. Like you sort of make us a part of the process even as we try to unpack what is he saying? What is it this time? And so you could talk a little bit about your art making and how you came to be an artist. I mean, obviously you went to school for it. You must have been doing it for a long time. Like, have you been drawing all your life? Was your art supported by your family? Do you have artists in your family?
Well, I guess to answer your first question, when it comes to the process of making art, I mean, I think it took me a long time to sort of arrive at who I am as an artist and the tools I sort of rely on. You know, I really, at some point, I really thought it was necessary to really think about how I was trying to communicate ideas. Because I know I use art as a filter to try to understand what's going on in the world around me. You know, whether it be history or media or popular culture, I used art my art as a filter for that. But I also really think about who am I making this for, why am I making it, and what am I trying to convey. And I think that's really important for me that the audience or the viewer can. They don't have to agree with it. Necessarily, but there needs to be some kind of exchange. There needs to be some kind of dialogue there. So if, you know, if I'm making a piece of work and sitting in a gallery, and I think my, you know, for me to honor the viewer, you know, the audience that's come to see this work, there should be something tangible there that they can like either disagree or agree with, or you know, have a conversation about either with me as the artist or with the other patrons that are there. I think that's kind of my responsibility to put that out there. And also, just I think it's important for me. It became important for me not to be tied down to one media, even though I you know I still do a lot of drawing. I rely on drawing a lot for. If I'm doing something 2D or 3D, and you know, I still have a printmaking as part of my process, depending on what I'm working on. But sometimes it can't be a print. Sometimes it needs to be, you know, sometimes it needs to be an installation, and you know, sometimes it can't be a drawing. It needs to be an object that I work on and I figure out how to do it, or it needs to be a series of drawings. And again, that's taking the viewer in mind the audience in mind and thinking about what's the best way to communicate. Sometimes in my work, a lot of difficult information and make it accessible, not necessarily palatable, but accessible so people can be able to have some kind of, again, interaction with the work or conversation with the work. As far as my artistic background, I'm the only artist in my family. Nobody else was really into what I was doing. I've got uncles on my mother's side who were musicians, but my family is always supportive about it, about the art, just like anything else that me or my sibling would do. They're making sure that we're prepared and we're taking it seriously. And my dad sort of got me started with the drawing bug just by bringing comic books home from different missions he would go on with the Air Force, and he would come back and he would grab all the comic books that his friends had, and he would bring them back home to me, and we would sit down and we would read them. And when I was done reading them or done rereading them for the eighth or ninth time, for some reason I just started to draw them from there. And that's sort of where it started for me, and I've been drawing ever since.
Mm-hmm. Nice, nice. You've got so many exhibits up presently. I wanted you to touch on them. Only one is closing this month, and that's Vanishing Point 3.9 Art Collective. We could talk about that one. That's at Cass Snyder Gallery in San Francisco, and that closes at the end of this month, which is, I guess, next week, on the 31st. And then you've got the rest of them continue into next year, except for the days and occasions that we mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, the Unexpected Griot at Southern Exposure, and that's through December 2nd. December 2nd, so people have a little time to get over there. So why don't you tell us about Vanishing Point?
So Vanishing Point, actually closed on October 13th. But Vanishing Point was an exhibit that John Zarabell, who's a local arts writer, educator, and curator, he reached out to the collective that I belong to called 3.9 Collective, and we're an African American arts collective. We've been around since 2011, so it's a group of Black artists, arts writers, arts educators, obviously artists, and we get together and we do a couple of group projects every year. And basically 3.9 stands for, it was basically a friend of mine, one of the members of the group, Ron Saunders, made me aware of this article that actually came out in the Bayview Reporter. And it was talking about the projected census based on the current census at that time. I guess the census report had just come out. And they were projecting that at the rate of decline of the African-American population in San Francisco, that by the next census, it would be, we'd be reduced down to about 3.9%. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, if our population is down to 3.9%, what percentage of those are artists or writers, or playwrights or, and so, we established a group to, to have a presence in the art world again here, and also to remind people that, that Black artists in the city have always contributed, to the conversation here. And so we started really slowly, and we've been picking up a lot of steam with people asking us to do projects. And I was grateful. And John Zarabell, who teaches at USF, was one of these people, and he came to us and asked us if we wanted to collaborate with him and with this exhibit. So Vanishing Point also speaks about to the idea of the disappearance of Black culture in San Francisco, And it was a very different show for us. It was obviously there was a gallery show, but leading up to that, there was a series of dinners that one of our members, Jacqueline Francis, put together in several different locations in San Francisco. So the first one was in a senior residence in the Bayview, where people were invited to have dinner with the residents, and the residents were there also encouraged to tell their stories about growing up here, living here in San Francisco, comparing the time they lived in versus what's going on now, and then those conversations continued to the African American art and culture complex, where there was another dinner where it was a little bit more cross-generational, where there was some people who just moved here to San Francisco, some younger people who were born here in San Francisco, and again some elders who again who were living here in San Francisco. And so it was a very interactive kind of exhibit, where it was, yes, there's artwork speaking to it, but there's also these series of dinners that where we're having these conversations, and these items were also gathered up and presented at the gallery at the JCC.
Oh, nice. You mean sort of like videotapes of the different dinners?
There were mementos, and I think there were some photographs by the people who were by the people who were attending some of the dinners. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, that sounds really great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have Re-Ecology. You're the artist in residence there at Re-Ecology, and that was started at the beginning of this month, and it goes through January 31st.
Yeah, that's a residency. So, yeah, that started at the beginning of this month. And basically, when you have a residency at Recology, you're there for 4 months, and you have access to the dump area, and you can scavenge, and you have a studio space, and you make art. All your art is generated and repurposed from the recycling area, from the dump area.
Okay. Oh, neat. You're finding some good material?
I had a really specific proposal that I was going to do when I went out there, and I've noticed that that has changed, because I've been finding all this, I've been attracted to all this old building material there, like lath that used to be in between walls and in people's houses, but nobody uses lath anymore. Discarded pieces of lumber, plywood, sheetrock, parts, kitchen cabinets, and parts of furniture from people's homes. And I've been really interested in sort of honoring the memory of these materials and where they came from, and the reason why a lot of them ended up at Recology, because a lot of the houses here are being torn down or being rebuilt, and unfortunately, in cases that means that not only people are being displaced, but also the memories are being displaced, like memories of that neighborhood where that house used to stand, or memories from that family or the families that then occupied these spaces. So yeah, I've been making a lot of work that I want to make work that sort of, again, honors these materials and honors those memories built around those materials.
Oh, nice. And I know you also teach. Are you at are you still at what is it, the school that my niece was at?
San Francisco Day School? I'm here right now.
Oh. Wow, I don't know how you fit all that in. You're an art teacher, and you make art like it seems like in all your other time. And yeah, it's just so wonderful that you could do all these things. How do you do all of this in one life?
Some days I just don't know. It was I think I was very very much pushing my limit at the beginning of the school year, with I was working on a proposal for the San Francisco Art Commission for the kiosk series. I was trying to get that done, and that involved me like interviewing people and getting stories, and then also working on the installation at Southern Exposure, which was logistically wasn't that hard because I just only live like a block away from Southern Exposure, so
Okay.
working there was really easy. And I have a really good schedule here, and I have a really supportive environment here at the day school that allows allows all of us in the art department to be able to make work. And because one of the requirements here and one of the expectations here is that everybody in the art department here is a working artist, so we all have projects that we're working on at all times.
Oh, nice, yeah. And then I just want to mention before you go, your Veterans Views art by those who served at the Triton Museum of Art in Santa Clara. It opens on November 11th, which is officially Veterans Day, although it's observed on the Friday the 10th, November 10th, and it's through February 4th, 2018. Are you going to be there? Is there like a reception on the 11th? Are you going to be in the gallery that day or not?
I think it opens on 11th, but I think the reception is on the 19th.
On the Thursday? Oh, the 19th. Oh, okay.
I think
Okay.
the 19th is a Sunday. November
Yeah,
the 19th.
it is. Oh, okay. All righty. And then you've got another exhibit that hasn't opened. It opens next year at the De Rossi Art. You're having, oh no, you have another residency, and that's in
Yeah, that's
Woodbine.
another residency.
Right. Well, that must be my next guest.
Okay.
So it's perfect timing. Thank you so much, Rodney, for this great conversation. I look forward to seeing the exhibit at Southern Exposure and some of these others. And man, I'm so happy you let me know what you're up to, because otherwise I would miss more than I'm missing.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me on.
All right, you take good care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Ah, good morning. Is that Otto Gonzalez and Luella Smith?
Yes,
Yes,
it
it
is.
is.
Super. Thanks for your flexibility given my technical difficulties. So I'm going to just read your bios, and then we can talk about this wonderful exhibition that I'm so looking forward to, the Reconstructed Refugee Camp and exhibit that's going to be opening in Oakland on Monday or on Tuesday, the 31st, and it's going to be through November 4th or 5th.
Hey, Wanda,
Yes.
Rachel is on the line as well. The dates
Oh.
of the exhibition are Monday, October 30th to Sunday, November 5th.
Oh, okay, super. All right, 'cause great. Oh, so there are three of you. Awesome.
Oh yeah, I won't be doing the interview, but I'm here sort of as moral support for Luella and Otto. Moral and technical.
Super. Well, Luella Smith is an emergency physician who has worked with Doctors Without Borders. How do you pronounce the French
Frontier.
thank you, also MSF, since 2006. And she can, including several missions working directly with displaced people. She has worked in Sudan, Niger, Central African Republic, Sri Lanka, Haiti, Cote d'Ivoire, Syria, Philippines, Nigeria, Libya, Jordan, and Yemen. Most recently, Luella was a medical referent for 3 months in Amran Project, Yemen, where MSF was providing care for internally displaced people. Luella lives in New Brunswick, Canada. When not on assignment with MSF, she provides medical care to indigenous populations in northern Canada. Luella received her medical degrees from, is it, how do you pronounce that, Dalhousie?
Dalhousie.
Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, and her bachelor's from the University of the Philippines. Wow. Well, welcome, Luella. You have such a varied palette there within your life and within your work.
Thanks, Juan.
You're welcome. And Otto Gonzalez, you're an MSF nurse and nursing supervisor who has completed 4 missions with Doctors Without Borders, MSF. You worked in Tanzania, DRC, Chad, and Honduras. Most recently, you supervised outpatient services and national staff nursing supervisors for 4 months in Nduta? Is that how you pronounce
Correct,
it?
Correct, yeah. Nduta is a camp that we opened up.
Oh, okay. What part of Tanzania is that? Because I've been to Tanzania.
So it's right along the Burundian border. There's essentially a series of camps that we were operating the medical end of things along that border.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and you're from the Pacific Northwest, not far from us in Bay City. When you're not on assignment, you work as a nurse supervisor in Tillamook County General Hospital, and you received your nursing degree from CLASSOP Community College?
CLASSOP Community College.
Yeah, where is that? Is that in the Pacific Northwest too?
Correct. It's in Astoria in Oregon.
Okay, okay. Yeah, I was up there for the totality.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was quite fun. Where were you all during the solar eclipse? Were you in another country?
I was actually there as well, actually drove a short ways down the coast to be in a place of totality with a couple of other MSF friends of mine from Canada who had come down to see it as well. We were right on the coast.
Nice, nice, yeah. And Luella, where were you when we had the solar eclipse?
I was actually in Norway visiting my daughter. I missed it altogether.
Oh, you couldn't see it from there? Okay. And Rachel, where were you?
I was at the MSF office in New York, and we all went out and watched it.
Yeah, that's just like one of those moments, right? So I was wondering first, perhaps, if you all could talk about the exhibit that Force from Home, and maybe you could maybe take turns describing it for our audience who haven't seen it yet and been able to, you know, to participate in a tour of the installation, which is going to be outside of the Henry J. Kaiser Convention Center park in the parking lot there on 10th Street in Oakland. So,
well, sure, Wanda. This is Otto. And so Force from Home, it's an exhibition that we have that kind of describes, one, the life that people have who are displaced. You know, there's over 65 million people that currently live displaced, mostly due to war, due to conflict. And we simply, in this exhibit, we're trying, like I said, to highlight what their lives are like, what the work that MSF does in those places. There's a guided tour led by a number of guides like Luella and myself. Each tour takes about an hour. We like to say they depart. They start about every 8 minutes.
Okay.
All the guides that are on there have worked in the field and have their own sort of different slight takes, experiences to share with that.
Luella?
Yeah, basically, just at the end of the hour, we hope people will have a sense of what it's like to be displaced. So the focus of the exhibit, as Otto mentioned, is to highlight the plight of these 65 million displaced people in the world at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was looking at some of the themes that are covered, like the push factors. You know, why do people flee their homes on the move? How do people navigate their journeys and cope with their vulnerabilities to exploitation, disease, and other challenges, the legal status, basic needs, health care, and shelter. So as clinicians, do you remember your first tour with Doctors Without Borders, and how did that impact you personally? Did you have any experiences with displaced persons prior to, you know, your first, assignment with Doctors Without Borders?
I'll go first. I'll start with I had had experience before I started with MSF. I had done volunteer work with other medical humanitarian groups. My first mission was in Congo, and I oversaw clinics I had a number of jobs. I oversaw the clinics in two IDP, internally displaced people's camps, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I ran a cholera treatment center while I was there. We say, and how does it influence me? It's, for me as a nurse, the best work that I do. I have no question when I'm there as to what I'm doing or why I'm there. I keep coming back, going out on mission. It's what I enjoy the most, even though it's super difficult to do, in healthcare.
For me, I well remember my very first mission. It was in Darfur, Sudan, during the Darfur War. And it really made an impact on me. Even just initially flying into the area where I was, just flying over all these villages that had been burned and that are just shells of villages, and then coming into the area where there were just masses of tents set up. And so we had a displaced persons camp of about 40,000 people, and we ran a 100-bed hospital there. And we were the only healthcare provider in the area. And so for me, yes, like Otto says, there's never any doubt of what you're doing there and how you're making an impact on the population. We also ran clinics on the rebel side of the border for people who could not access our hospital. So for me, it was... my very first mission, it certainly made an impact on me and made me want to keep coming back to MSF. That's it.
Yeah. So, Ala, you mentioned that you have also worked with other medical first responding organizations, like which one, and how did you decide to join MSF and continue, you know, to work in that particular organization?
So a couple of different organizations that I've gone out with, an organization based out of Portland called Medical Teams International. I've also one ran by the University of Miami, where I worked in Haiti. They run a hospital there. And so MSF, why did I choose MSF? One, to me, I think it is the best medical humanitarian organization that exists. I think we do great work. The scope of the work is really broad. The amount of the number of patients that we see, the amount of work we're able to accomplish. Realize that we're currently in 71 countries. There's approximately 35,000 people out in the field at any given time, of which only 10% are like Llewellyn and myself, who more so manage programs, oversee programs. 90% of our staff is local staff, local national staff. I prefer the term local because national isn't necessarily always correct. Tanzania is a good example where the staff that worked with me were both Tanzanian and Burundian, so it becomes a mix. It's who is there. And we're the only way we're able to accomplish things on the scale that we do is with the number of national staff we have, with 90% of those people being national staff. We couldn't get nearly the amount of work done that we do if it were just us going there and giving direct care.
That's the thing that I like about MSF is we do a lot of supervision and teaching, so we increase the capacity in the countries in which we work. And we also contribute, obviously, to the economy because we pay our staff. So, and many of the staff that work with us are themselves displaced people. So, it's a great organization, and it's an independent organization because all our money comes from private donors. So nobody has any agenda except to provide humanitarian medical care.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. Yeah. I was wondering if, I don't know, it seems like you have to be kind of brave to do that kind of direct service kind of work. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of your training, because it's more than medical school, I'm sure, covers, unless you're used to doing emergency medical care, let's say in like Highland Hospital or San Francisco General or Cook County facility. I think that's in Chicago. I mean, there are places where emergency care is maybe on par with some of the kind of injuries one might see in a particular environment that's at war. But then there are other things you know that you see that are probably pretty tragic and probably heart-wrenching, because you might also not be able to save everyone. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your training and how did you recharge?
Okay. For me, like from the medical point of view, the medicine actually that we practice over there, we see totally different pathologies a lot of the time. Sure, the trauma is the same, but also bear in mind that these places where we work don't have the same resources that we do here in North America. So it's totally different training that's necessary. I guess you have to be flexible. You have to adapt to what resources you have. We see a lot of things like malnutrition and cholera, which I don't see here in North America. So, the pathologies are totally different. So, we need to recharge. I still like to keep my foot in the door here in North America because, as I said, I have to keep up my license and the practice is a little different. So, that's basically it for me.
For me, long before I was a nurse, I was a medic. I was a paramedic down in L.A. So that gave me some, background on working in tense situations, which helped with going into MSF. A lot of like what Luella says as well, you know, we're treating people who, you know, in this country would not suffer, would not die from the same problems. Diarrhea that quite literally kills children because they don't have treatment for it. That just simply wouldn't exist here. A lot of it is just really simple things like that that we can do to keep people from dying, to keep people alive, to make them better. Malaria, where I was, malaria was a huge issue in Induta. When I worked there, the last place that I worked, simple things like mosquito nets, which they didn't have, we assist in providing those. We treat the people with malaria. In some ways, a lot of it becomes really simple, but it just simply doesn't exist if we're not there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that really answered your question exactly.
It does. It does. So what made you want to go into the healing arts in the first place? Do you have a parent or family that's in the medical field or healer? What attracted you to this type of career and this type of work?
As I said, I was a paramedic a long time ago. I actually got completely out of medicine for 10 years, and then I went back to school and became a nurse simply because I felt I needed to. I felt this is something that I can do. And I think with working with MSF, I've learned that it's the specific settings that we're in and stuff like that. I function well in those environments. And I just feel like I can get a lot more accomplished. I can't just sit back and not help people if I feel there's a way that I can help people. I can't just not do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For me, I grew up in the Philippines, and since I was 10 years old, I think I decided I wanted to be a physician. So, so it's always been something that I wanted to do.
Well, having traveled to so many different countries, I guess each place sort of leaves a marker. So maybe we could talk about some of the lasting type of connections that you have with some of the folks. You don't have to talk about all the countries, but, you know, some that, like, whoa, you know, this mother and her child, or this family, or, you know. Tell us a story.
What? I don't know. Do you want to go first of all?
Okay. I always say that I always leave a piece of my heart in every country that I've been to, because when you work so closely with the people that are there, and you just hate to leave a project. But that's the nature of MSF, is there is a turnover. And for our national staff, I'm sure it's very difficult for them, because they see a turnover of expats like us. So I always try to keep in touch with one person from each project, if I can. And in this day of technology, it is possible. I keep touch mostly with the staff that we've worked with. For example, one of the nurses that worked with me in Central African Republic years ago, after the recent conflict, has become now a refugee in Chad. So he's been living in a refugee camp now for the last 2 years, and he was one of our nurses in the project that I worked with many years ago. So it's these stories, you know. One of our radio operators in Sudan is now displaced, and he's in Egypt waiting for his papers to be processed. So there are a lot of displaced people that have been in our project, yeah, in our lives.
I just want to add exactly what Luella is saying. I work with some amazing people in the different projects that I've worked in, who are indeed are living displaced. They're living in a tent, in a refugee, in an IDP camp. Previous to this, they were living back in their homes, living normal middle-class lives, and they have to leave. And now they find themselves in this predicament. And again, amazing people, wonderful people that I've worked with. And I have kept in contact with different people from different projects, and always will. They truly are like family to me.
Jason?
Yeah, a little bit, Jason, not quite finished with my current interview. Ah, wow.
I guess that's all the part of the message that we want to impart with this exhibit, is that the people that are displaced are people just like you and me. They're just ordinary people that just happen to live in a place that's in conflict. So because of the circumstances, they've been displaced and forced to leave their homes.
A particular item that I see a lot of people bring with them when they end up in these camps is they bring their keys. They bring their keys to their homes because they expect that they hope that they will go back one day. Who knows? Their towns, their villages may be destroyed, but they have that hope, and they bring their keys, you know, thinking that one day they'll be able to go back home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how long are you on a particular mission before you get moved to another one? Is there a certain length of time that you get to stay?
I usually work about 6 months, and something to what Luella talked about earlier, I try to keep my feet in both worlds. I'll be out on mission for 6 months. I try to work here for about a year or so, go back out on mission, and make that sort of balance like that.
Mm-hmm. So it's your choice?
It's my choice. What do you mean it's my choice?
Insofar as how long you stay on a mission, and then when you leave and then go back?
It also depends on the mission. Different missions have different goals. You're in different missions for different amounts of time. My last one in Tanzania, indeed I was there just shy of 4 months, but that was one in which we quite literally, we opened a camp, we built a hospital out of a bunch of abandoned buildings. In that setting, we were working 7 days a week. pretty much as if you're awake, you're working. And that's just really intense. And that first startup phase is usually shorter. And then people come in to manage it, run it. There's a couple of people on this very tour, as tour guides, who worked to the exact same location after I left. So it's kind of interesting, too, to see how things progress in the project that we're working in.
Right.
Yeah, my missions have varied from emergency missions, which are 1 to 2 months, and then the longer term, 6-7 months as well. So it varies considerably.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the exhibit that's opening on Monday at the Henry J. Kaiser Center parking lot in Oakland on 10th, I was wondering sort of what is the hope for the audience of Forced from Home exhibition that Doctors Without Borders is, you know, building with this refugee camp, an exhibition that you all are going to be giving people tours through?
In some ways, I think it's really very basic. It is simply to raise awareness. 65.7 million people, the largest number since World War II, currently live displaced. They're on the run all the time. And we want to, you know, bring to light, bring to focus the plight of those people around the world. It's not just in a particular area. It really is occurring all around the world at this time.
And it's also part of MSF's mission. It's témoignage, which is bearing witness. So this is what we're doing, is bearing witness for the advocating for all the displaced people in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I read in the press materials that internally displaced persons in America, in the United States specifically, is not necessarily a part of the exhibition. And I presume that's probably given the resources that are here in this country. However, you know, it's not hard to see, you know, when we're looking at all the homeless populations here in the Bay Area, that there is overlap. So what do you tell people who see that connection between Forced from Home exhibition participants and what's happening right here on the ground, right where we live?
I guess for the Forced from Home, most of the people that we work with in other countries are forced from home by virtue of violence and conflict and war, and that's probably the biggest difference.
And something, you know, we are MSF. We are a medical organization providing medical health care issues around the world. We're not necessarily an organization that provides shelter, those sorts of things. We don't build houses. We don't do those sorts of things in general. So it's kind of a different mandate. It's not something that MSF and what we do can add a lot of value to what is going on here. As I say, people have access to health care, those sorts of things, and shelter is not necessarily one of our big goals. When we work in projects around the world, in Congo, in Tanzania, and stuff like that, there'll be other partner organizations that will be providing the shelter, those sorts of things, the UNHCR and some other organizations as well, directly covering those needs.
Okay. So it sounds like you collaborate with other organizations that provide other aspects of the need of the population that you're serving, whether that's housing or other types of services.
Food.
Yeah, food.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Correct.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's great. So last question. So with Doctors Without Borders, what's the longest that that you all stay in a particular area or region? And I mean, I know you might stay for 4 months, but then that doesn't mean necessarily that the mission is over there. So how long is the longest stay?
Well, I'll use the example of Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We have been in Congo, I don't know the exact numbers, probably for about 15 years, something like that, or more. And we're not necessarily a development organization, but we are in places working long-term, both, like I said, with refugee displaced populations, plus also we treat HIV patients in these places that we are. We're treating patients with TB in these places that we are. And these are indeed long-term projects. You can't just come in, treat somebody once or something like that for these types of diseases and move along. So a number of our places are very long-term. I couldn't tell you what the longest places that we have been are. Congo is probably right up there.
15 years is significant. Mm-hmm.
It's something, my apologies, I don't know the exact time, but I know that we've been there probably at least that, if not more.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then the people that you know that you've kept in contact with that are now in refugee camps or in exile, can they join the Doctors Without Borders if they wanted to work there where they are?
So I'll use Tanzania as an example. Indeed, the staff that we have, the nurses that worked alongside me, and it's not just healthcare people that we hire. We hire all kinds of people. We hire doctors, nurses, logistical people, administrative people. The list goes on and on. But indeed, those are oftentimes people who are living in the camps. And it's simply like applying for a job, like any other job. They come to us with their information, their CVs and such, and we interview them, and potentially we give them employment.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you want to talk about or share as we conclude our conversation?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes,
likewise. You're quite welcome. Look forward to meeting you on the tour next week.
Cool.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Wanda. I really appreciate it. And let me know if you have any other questions. I can look up for you the answer to that last question. I don't have it off the top of my head either, but if it's something you'd want, I can find it online.
Okay, sure. Yeah, you can give it to me exactly if you like. But, you know, I was just wondering how long it 15 years or 10 years or 20, that's significant investment in the health of a community. That's really great.
Sure. I'll see what I can find and I can send it to you.
Okay, thank you. Well, you all have a great rest of the day in building this this camp, because I know you have to construct it.
You're correct. You are correct. Thank
all
you
right.
very
thank
much.
Thank you, Wanda.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a good blessing. Bye. Looking for my notes.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm looking for my notes, Jason. So I got to scroll. So Jason Johnson, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your film. Tell us about it. It looks really. I mean, the premise is really redress. It's a different way of looking at racism and what do you do when you're angry? What do you do with that? Do you take it out on the whole community because of the race of the person who did you injury? Since I haven't seen the film, I don't know what happens with that, but I did watch it, and it looks kind of scary. But I know that your cast is like, wow. I mean, a lot of them live here in the San Francisco Bay Area, quite a few of them for that matter, which is pretty cool. So why don't you tell us about the film, and then I'll read your bio, which is really, you're a celebrity yourself, and then we'll talk more about the work. So tell us what your film is about, Redress.
Okay, Redress is about a Caucasian man and his wife and child. One day, his wife and child are killed by a black drunk driver And during the grieving process, he meets a neo-Nazi bartender who tells him that he should go out and take out the family of the offender, a la eye for an eye. So the story follows the Caucasian man descent into his grief and his ultimate decision to exact revenge. So that's the premise of the story.
Wow. Yeah. So what happened to forgiveness, right?
Yeah. You know, it's these are really interesting times that we live in. I think that we, you know, racism aside, we're also in a instant gratification time in our lives where, you know, we want our problems to be solved immediately. And And I feel that those were one of the factors of me writing and ultimately making the story. You know, things happen and we don't really have control over it. But, you know, it is the right thing to do to not single out a particular group of people just because an incident happened, or to also take time to process what happened and to make a sound decision instead of something that's a hasty decision.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then if the person is the one who's grieving, in this case, you know, the husband and father of the deceased persons, if he's sitting in a bar drinking, then he already, you know, he's clouding his judgment. Because you can't think straight if you're inebriated. And just thinking, I was just thinking, even if he, you know, sort of entered into, once he finished being angry, you know, a restorative justice model of you know, looking at what happened, because no matter what he does, he's not going to bring back his wife and child.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how does he feel on the end of that? I mean, we'll have to watch the movie to see. When is your movie opening?
So I think that it will be done by the end of November, and we're going to go ahead and enter it into film festivals, and we'll show it that way. Next month on the 10th, I have a meeting with the NAACP, and they may be endorsing the film, and if that is the case, then we'll be setting up screenings through the NAACP for, you know, the purpose of watching the film and having discussions after the film.
Mm-hmm. The national NAACP or which, where at? Which one? Which chapter, if not?
This is a regional one, so it's the Northern California chapter.
Okay, okay. Are you in Northern California?
I am. I'm actually in the East Bay area. I live in El Cerrito.
Okay. So yeah. So that's why you know people that live here being your guest. Okay. Yeah. Well, you earned your MA degree, Master of Arts degree in film production from Eastern Illinois University, and then you took a marketing position working for legendary film director Francis Ford Coppola. You worked on several wine and food ventures, and then transitioned over to Coppola's film studio, American Zoetrope. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's correct.
Okay. You worked under film producers Walter Murch, Richard Beggs, and Mr. Coppola himself. You took Coppola's advice to go out and become famous, and now you are famous as a producer.
Maybe a local celebrity.
Yeah, and as a freelance producer, you work for Strike 5 Films. Is that your company, Strike 5 Films?
It is.
Okay. So what films have you produced that we know or that we don't know, that we will know, we'll go look up afterwards?
I've produced two feature films, and I've produced about 10 short films.
Wow.
The films that were features, the first one was called Keep It Simple, Stupid, and it was a It was a love story about kind of a wandering guy and a traditional Indian girl that, you know, eventually find love. The second feature film was another Bollywood film called Pariharam, and that dealt with, it was another love story. Many Bollywood films are love stories, just in case listeners don't know, but the second film was a love story that kind of centered around magic realism and a little bit of time travel. So that was a really interesting film to work on. And then the other films I worked on are just short films that I've had an opportunity to do here in the Oakland, East Bay area, and a couple down in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. So what attracted you, you know, to film, to that particular industry? Have you always been a storyteller? Did you like films, you know, as you were coming up, you know, from, you know, as a child into adulthood? So what's the attraction of this kind of storytelling?
I think I've always been interested in storytelling. When I was a child, you know, I was interested in sports and everything just like anyone else, but what really grabbed my attention was watching movies and just understanding, you know, just the production behind it, and just, you know, how was that made, and how would you even get a job for that? So I just always found that really interesting, and as time went on, I found that whatever I did somehow gravitated towards making films, and it didn't even matter if I was in a completely unrelated job. Making films was always the end goal, so that's ultimately what, you know, I eventually came to know and just say, okay, I think this is what I'm created for, so that's what I'm going to try to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you working on something now? Because Redress, you're in the production aspect of that, you know, being able to get it endorsed and then screened and sent out. So are you the kind of artist that you're doing multiple projects at the same time?
Oh yeah, I am. So I always try to have a lot of irons in the fire. So what I'm working on next is a skateboard bandit film called Grip Tape.
And, Grip Tape?
Oh. Mm-hmm. And that film project made it to the second round of the Sundance Writing Labs. Mm-hmm. And then also a production company that released Aubrey Goes West contacted me about the rights to purchase it. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have a really good project. I'm looking to build off of the success of Redress, and then we'll see how that could directly affect the making of Grip Tape. But, I'm also writing a story called Roger and Me, a love story. I want to do something completely different than Redress, something that's happy. So I'm really looking forward to fast-tracking that project as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to Redress. So tell us about this fantastic cast. Who plays the grieving husband, father? Who plays the person who starts the ball rolling, literally, you know, with the injury, accident, you know, of the protagonist's, you know, wife and child, and you just your cast it looks pretty phenomenal. So why don't you tell us, you know, who the stars are in your film Redress?
Yeah, so you know, I want to say that without the help of Steve Nichols and Rosie Cruz Ferdin, our casting directors, we couldn't have gotten the talent that we had. But that said, The lead role is a great actor by the name of Jason Kyle. Jason Kyle, interestingly enough, is a comedic actor, and when he auditioned for this role, I told him that, you know, this is something that's completely different from the wheelhouse that, you know, that they're used to, but, you know, if you're up for it, then I'd love to have you, because, you know, his audition was just so great. And then moving on to our bartender, the fantastic actor by the name of Mick Hodder. Mick actually just was signed. He's now a represented actor. So I think that you're going to see a lot of big things coming from Mick, Jason, also Grace England, who played the mother in the film. Another wonderful actress. And Selai West, who is she's a star herself, you know. If we're talking about celebrities, she's really the star, because she is a runway model that appears at New York Fashion Week, L.A. Fashion Week. She's on several magazine covers. So, you know, we just overall, we were really blessed by the talent and the people that wanted to be associated with this project, and just really lucky. So it made my job that much easier.
Mm-hmm. So the person who's driving the car that is involved in the vehicular manslaughter, he's not even in the film, huh?
No, actually, he's not. So how we achieved that, because, you know, with the... with a short film, you have a pretty limited amount of time to kind of build the narrative and to keep the audience's attention. So what we did with that is, like anyone today, a lot of people get their information from their cell phones. In the story, we have a newspaper article with a picture of the drunk driver on it, and that conversation happens in the bar. So the picture is shown on the cell phone to the bartender, and that way we're able to introduce a character without physically having them there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But that's interesting. But then you have the daughter, portrayed by Soleil, and
mm-hmm.
and then you have the wife, I presume, portrayed by Gloria Stingley?
Yes.
She plays the wife. Yeah, and I know her work. She is awesome. So how do we meet the wife and daughter when and the husband is not in the picture? How do you do that part?
So at the end, I guess you could say the antagonist pays a visit,
yes,
to their house. And they're in the house, and they are leaving. I don't want to give it away. So, but he pays them a visit at their house, and that is kind of the end of the film. So, we have a brief introduction of the mother and the daughter's relationship, and from there they're going to make a trip. And then everything kind of comes to a head at that point.
Okay, sounds really intriguing. How long is the film?
The film is 12 minutes and 32 seconds.
Wow, you do
with the credit scroll. Yeah.
Wow, because I would think that making a short film is harder than making a long film.
You know, I think in a lot of ways it is, because, you know, with a short film, like I was saying earlier, you have a really small time to, you know, get the narrative, you know, what is this film about, and the time is ticking, because, you know, short films are typically they're less than 15 minutes to get into a bona fide film festival. So you don't have a lot of time to introduce characters or to tell their motivation. So every line of dialogue or every action needs to essentially be moving the story forward. And there's not a lot of time for just talking heads or just dead space, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So you worked under some film pioneers. How did you happen to work for all those film pioneers that you mentioned, particularly Coppola, but, you know, Walter Murch and Richard Beggs. I don't know Richard Beggs' name. Talk about, you know, sort of how you ended up working for these men. And then you also, you know, mentioned that, you know, you've also been, you know, working on your films in the Sundance studios as well. So you sound like you're pretty well connected, which says a lot for you because of the company you keep, right? talk a little bit about your mentors and how they might show up, you know, insofar as your style or the way you do certain things for people that might know their work and their style and their productions.
Sure. So I'll start with people that have influenced me, and then I'll just kind of go how I came to work for Francis Coppola. A couple of filmmakers that have always influenced me have been Larry Clark. He did a series of films, but he's most known for a film called Kids. That movie deals with the AIDS epidemic in New York and, I guess, reckless kids kind of going towards that. What really draws me to Larry Clark's work is the real gritty sense of how he captures his characters. And I feel that his uncompromising style is something that, you know, really attracted me to a lot of his movies. So in this story, I kind of took some elements of kind of how he approaches his characters and I kind of, you know, did it in my own way. So that's one director that I really admire. Another is Andrea Arnold, and she's, you know, she's such a fantastic filmmaker. She's done a series of short films. I think her first short film was called Wasp, and she's recently done a film called American Honey, which is about magazine crews that travel across the U.S. selling, you know, magazine subscriptions. And what I really like about her style is she takes ordinary people that most people wouldn't really think about or consider to be a headlining part of a story. And she does a fantastic depiction and just narrative of these ordinary people. So I just really love the way that she approaches, you know, her writing. I love the way that she captures her characters and just the simple format of just how her stories are, but at the same time, they're very rich. So those are two filmmakers that really encouraged me to make films and to you know, do films uncompromised in your way. And how I came to work for Coppola was, I don't really know how I came to work for him. I just, I remember that I was, you know, I had finished college and I had a girlfriend that had gotten a job here. So I didn't have a job at the time. So I came to California and filled out a lot of applications. And then just one day I got a call back from this winery in Napa. And it just so happened to be Francis Coppola. And I worked for his marketing team for a while and had a couple of crazy ideas that I think that he might have liked. And before I knew it, you know, I was kind of interning with his post-production crew. So that's kind of how, a very short explanation of how I got started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So were you in East Illinois still when you came to California?
So I was in Illinois. I went to Eastern Illinois, and I knew I always wanted to work in film, but it, you know, working in film seems like, you know, how do you do it? It almost seems impossible, you know. So I know a lot of people have dreams to work in Hollywood and the glitz and glamour of it, but it's really not that. It's actually a lot of work. But what I guess looking from the outside in, it just seemed like, you know, how do you even get into it? You have to be someone like, you know, have all this talent like, you know, Francis Ford Coppola or know somebody. And I didn't have all that talent and I didn't know anyone. So it was just kind of a dream or just a seed of an idea for me for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's so interesting, you know, that you would, you know, made the films about, you know, wineries and then, you know, we have, you know, these fires, you know, here in the North Bay. So you probably know people from your work that were directly affected by the fires, although I was listening to the news yesterday that most of the vineyards were okay, that they weren't necessarily affected by the fires. They didn't burn. You know, people that worked there were affected, but not necessarily the vineyards. So did you, were you affected? Do you have people that you're still in touch with from your work early on in your career as a director?
I do. I actually, the executive producers of Redress, great family, Alan and Leslie Barbo, who've always have supported me, their home was actually in severe danger. And they live along Dry Creek Road, and the homes on the northern part of Dry Creek Road and some parts of the southern part were completely, torched. But somehow their house was able to make it unscathed. So, that really hits home because, you know, they're a family. The Barables and the Dwyers are families that, you know, I really love. And and, you know, I don't want to see anyone get hurt, but, you know, that really hit home for me. So to see that, you know, it really shows you how things could just change in a matter of moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, well, that's great that they were spared. So many weren't. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wow. So why don't you give your website so people can follow you or your you know, the production, you know, where it's moving, you know, if you get that NAACP endorsement, then, okay, well, where it's going to be the first screening conversation.
Sure. You could probably just do a Google search, and you could do hashtag redress film, and our film will pop right up. Or if you like to type out website addresses, you can it is redress redress weebly.com, and that is our film site. Mr. Coppola told me, don't spend any money until you absolutely have to. So There's several websites out there that will allow you to create your website, but you have to pay for the extension to be dropped off. So taking his advice, I just decided to keep the extension, and, you know, I just kind of go from there. But, yeah, that's where you can find us online.
Mm-hmm. Cool, cool. Well, congratulations on all of the awards, you know, on the film so far, and I'm looking forward to seeing it, you know, once, you know, you start taking it around in the different film festivals and community screenings and conversations, because definitely there's a whole lot there, you know, to talk
about.
Yeah,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Super. Well, I look forward to talking to you again in the near future when you, you know, have your next feature, Roger and Me, which is not as it's a happier film, as you said.
I promise it will be a much happier film.
Right. Well, you take good care, and thanks again so much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me on, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. Peace and blessings.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. So, well, we have it. well, this has been a different kind of Wanda's Picks, and, yeah, but we're coming from you live, and we're being really creative here. We're going to let a little technology snafu keep us from doing our thing. So take good care, and there's so much happening this weekend that folks want to take advantage of. And one of those things is the film tonight, Happy, the Role of Economics on the Development of Civilization, and that's taking place at the Guild Theater, 2828 35th Street in Sacramento, and that starts at 5:30 and it goes to 9:30, and the panelists for this weekend are going to be Dr. Wade Nobles, Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and Professor James Small, and it's going to be narrated by Philippe Shock Matthews. It's going to be really awesome. For information, you can call 916-538-9461, HAPPILMN.com, happyfilm.com is where you can find out more about the film. Tonight is the extended sneak preview. And then tomorrow, African Americans for Balance Health present Accelerating African Spiritual Growth. And it's going to be from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Registration starts at 9:30, and the event starts at 10. It's located at the Dr. Ephraim Williams Family Center, 4036 14th Avenue in Sacramento. And you can get your tickets at African Americans for Balanced Health, aabh.eventbrite.com. All ticket sales are final, they say. And for information, you can call. Again, the phone number is toll-free, 877-491-AABH or 2224. 877-491-2224. And the last part is AABH for African Americans Balanced Health. So it should be really super. And also this weekend, it's Open Studios in San Francisco. It's the closing weekend for Zaco Dance Company's presentation of The View from Here. That's tonight through Sunday. It's an hour long, and on Sunday there's going to Saturday afternoon, it's going to be conversation, panel discussion afterwards. And there's a poetry reading tonight from 6:30 to 7:30 at Maliki West African Restaurant on MacArthur Boulevard. The poets, West Oakland to West Africa poets are having a fundraiser. Poetry reading should be really fun. I am one of the poets that's presenting. And what else is happening? Kendra Kimbrough's home season is beginning tonight, and that should be really awesome. And that is going to be, let me see, it's Where is it taking place? Let's see. It's called In the Meantime, and it's two performances, Saturday, October 28th at 7:30, and Sunday, October 29th at 4 p.m. at Laney College, Odell Johnson Theater, 900 Fallon Street. So if you were at Push Festival this year, you saw a little bit of the wonderful work that it's a tribute to the strength and resilience of women faced with breast cancer. So the whole piece is being performed. It's being reprised. And Delina Patrice Brooks, who was a part of the Afro solo performances last week, is the writer and co-director of In the Meantime. So it's going to be really awesome. So you don't want to miss that. It's a really beautiful work. And what else is happening? Gosh. William Rose and Christine Mays have their show at William Rose Studio. And the party is tonight, and then they're going to be at the studio all day tomorrow and all day Sunday for the Open Studios of San Francisco. And you don't want to forget to go check out Rodney Ewing's work at Southern Exposure. It's there through, is it next month? I don't remember exactly. You need to check that out. All righty, so that's off the top of my head. My goodness, how do I keep all that in it? And I really enjoyed barbecue at SF Playhouse. You don't want to miss that. All righty, so you take care. Thank you again for joining us for another edition of Wanda's Picks in a different format. All righty, you take care. Peace and blessings.